Thanks for joining us at Cults to Consciousness. This storytelling podcast is meant to be for entertainment purposes only and does not substitute for any medical advice. We may discuss triggering topics, and we ask that you make your personal mental health a priority. Lastly, the opinions of our guests do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the host.
Initially, they did take me to the doctor when they found out I had the eating disorder that I was really trying to hide. And the doctor recommended therapy. And so I asked my mom when we got back home, I was like, okay, am I going to do therapy? She was like, no, absolutely not. And I was like, well, mom, if I don't get therapy, like, how are my problems going to get fixed? And I remember she said, problems? What problems? You don't have any problems. You just need to eat more.
Oh.
Therapy would be considered sinful. To go outside of the church, outside of the cult, to literally an outsider who's of the world, like, we were taught, first of all, they can't possibly help you because they're not coming at it from a biblical perspective. But yeah, like that, medication, therapy were never an option. We were kind of taught, again, that it's not that you need therapy, it's that you need to get right with God. And that's literally what my mom told me at one point. She was like, you know, if you were just right with God, if you were more godly, you wouldn't have an eating disorder. It would just go away.
Hey, my name is Shalise Ansola, and this is Cults to Consciousness, where we discuss leaving high-demand religions or organizations and finding healing and independence through awareness and true individual sovereignty. As always, if you're only listening and you want to see our faces, you can go to our YouTube channel at Cults to Consciousness. I love it when you guys interact with the videos, you leave your words of encouragement for our guests who are coming on and being so vulnerable, sharing their stories, helping us raise awareness about these culty groups, and hitting that subscribe button also means a lot. Showing me that you are an advocate, a supporter of exposing these culty groups. So thank you so much for your support. So today's guest, she reached out to us because she has a story about the IBLP. And as far as the channel goes, it's been a while since we've dove into this topic. We initially did it when we were talking about the Shiny Happy People documentary. Highly recommend. It follows the Duggars, the 19 Kids and Counting show, if anyone's ever seen it. And that's kind of the ideology that they followed. They became the poster children of the IBLP, which is a set of principles that was founded by Bill Gothard. And it's not technically its own religion. It permeated a whole bunch of Christian religions, specifically, I would say, the fundamentalist Christian religions, within their rules being so strict and intense. And we're going to be talking with our guest today about how she was born and raised in this IBLP, the different boarding schools or camps that she was sent to, how she uncovered her sexuality as coming out gay when she was a little bit older in life, and she was realizing that she had these repressed feelings going on because of this religion. And we're going to get all up into her story, and I'm so excited. So thank you so much for joining us, Oceana.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, of course. And this isn't your first time speaking. You've been on with Davey. We had him on when we were talking about the IBLP. He's awesome.
Yes.
Comedian. Highly recommend checking out his page as well. And he was like, yeah, Shalise, you got to check out this girl. She's got a crazy story. And so we love those referrals. We love it when you guys reach out to us. So let's get into first just a little bit of an overview of the IBLP. It's, tell me if I'm getting this wrong, Institute and Basic Life Principles, right?
Yes, correct.
It's a set of rules, again, that were implemented by Bill Gothard, and it's this umbrella system where you have God, and then you have the patriarchy, and then under that are the women and the children, and it's really all about submitting to the patriarchy, submitting to someone above you. And so there really is no room for women in power. It leaves a lot of room for predators to thrive because you're kind of told that you have to submit to the men in your life in all different ways or you'll get in trouble for it. They really highly recommend the modesty as far as women shouldn't be wearing pants. They should always be in skirts, covered up. They had all of these rules about modesty where you can't even have a slit in your skirt because it's pointing to your crotch, or you have to have the high neckline. So tell me some of the things that you remember that really stood out to you as far as the rules in the IBLP that affected you.
Yeah. So kind of what you touched on with that umbrella teaching, or the umbrella of authority is what it was called. That was one of their main teachings, which then a lot of rules stemmed from. I would say that's definitely one of their top teachings, but kind of like you said, basically it's, you know, God at the very top. God is kind of the umbrella of protection. And then underneath that is the Father. And it's this like funneled down hierarchy, because under the Father is the mother. The mother has to submit to the father completely, and underneath the mother are all of the children. And the basic, I mean, the gist of it is, if you're underneath that umbrella, following God's design for authority and submitting to all of your authorities all the way up, you'll be safe, you'll be protected, your life will go smoothly, almost like it's a magic charm, kind of. But if you step out from under that umbrella, then you're exposed, you're not protected, and all Satan's fiery arrows can get you. And then you're more susceptible to sin, you're more susceptible to bad things happening. If bad things are happening in your life, it's not because that's just life sometimes. You know, it's like you did something to cause this. There's sin, there's some type of hidden sin in your life. So it really fosters this environment where you want to pretend to be perfect and that everything is going well, because if it's not going well, then, well, you're bad. You're doing something bad. There's sin in your life. So just a very unhealthy environment, kind of like you touched on again, very, very patriarchal, very misogynistic. Women were not allowed to have any positions of leadership, even in the church. It was all about controlling women. And of course, one of the ways they're doing that is through controlling, you know, women's sexuality, controlling what you wear. We had to be very covered up because we were taught that as women, our bodies are bad, our bodies are sinful and will cause men to stumble. If a man is looking at us and lusting after us, it's not that man's problem. It's not that man's fault, you know, for being a creep or a predator or whatever. It was always the woman's fault. Well, you did something to cause it. You were acting flirtatious, or you were dressing in a way that caused him to stumble. So it's your fault. Yeah, just a very toxic environment, not empowering to women whatsoever. And definitely the type of environment that does attract and breed predators. I think in the Shiny Happy People documentary, someone in there said something to the effect of, this was a cult that gave the father all of the power and control. So if he wanted, essentially they were saying, if the father wanted to take all that power and control that the cult handed to him so easily and just run with it, he could. So a lot of fathers were highly, highly abusive and controlling. The mothers too definitely could be that way as well, but there's kind of that built-in caveat that, you know, the mothers do have to submit to the fathers. Like the man, he has the last say in everything, his word goes. Like, it's not an equal team, you know, with a female and a male, a mother, father. It's very unequal, very much a power imbalance for sure. But yeah, then all the rules just kind of stemmed from the basic teachings they had. Another teaching that they had that was very prevalent, very important, was the teaching of design. So we're all born with a particular design. For example, me being born a female, my design in life is to be a wife and mother. And that's pretty much all I could aspire to.
Right.
Now, I was kind of lucky in that my family, while we were very strict and very involved in it, particularly when I was younger, luckily we weren't quite to the extreme that some families took it, like the Duggars, for example. We were similar to them in like the rules that we followed, the standards that we held, especially for like modesty, but not quite to their level. Growing up the Duggar girls, it's my understanding that they could never wear pants. Whereas, for example, my parents would sometimes let us wear pants. And then throughout my life, they would have times where they would try to like kind of crack down and be even more strict. And they would say like, okay, we know that we've let you wear pants previously, but at least for now, during the school hours, you have to be in a dress and you can't take off the dress until like 3 p.m. So they would kind of vacillate, you know, between how strict they would be. As we got older, they did get more progressive, and especially as like the cracks in the facade started to show before we eventually left. So I was lucky in that regard. I was lucky in that even though I was born a woman, and was not, according to the cult, I shouldn't have been allowed to go to college. It was highly discouraged for girls to be educated beyond high school because we didn't need to be. We didn't need an education. We weren't going to have a career. We weren't going to work. That was not God's design for us. That was sinful, in fact. We were supposed to just find a godly man, get married as soon as possible, and just, you know, start pumping out babies as soon as possible, have as many kids as possible, because that was another one of their teachings. Abortion, obviously. Birth control, both are wrong. We weren't allowed to, or not supposed to use those in the cult. We were just supposed to kind of leave our family size up to God. And the more children you have, the more blessed you are, and the more children that you then have to send out into the world and like different sectors within the world to kind of take over the world and take it back for Christ, is what they said. Basically, it's kind of the whole make America great thing again, which is, you know, it's obviously only great for pretty much, you know, men and more specifically white men. But yeah, they basically wanted you to just have as many kids as possible to take over the world, which is very kind of disturbing when you actually think about it, that type of ideology.
It's very Handmaid's Tale.
Yeah, I've never actually watched The Handmaid's Tale, ironically enough. I've heard a lot about it, and people very close to me have recommended that I not watch it, and I think it would be too triggering and like just too close to home. Very much like Handmaid's Tale from what I have heard and understand.
Yeah, they're trying to take over the world for Jesus, basically, and inject themselves into every sect of society, so politics or government and schools and prisons, which they were actually pretty successful at doing,
yeah,
putting their programs into prisons and schools. And they're basically creating their own little army. And I mean, there was videos on the Shiny Happy People of these young men in military uniforms that were for the IBLP. And so it was kind of a scary image, I guess you would say, where I'm just like, oh boy, they're really trying to do a thing here and kind of succeeding in a way. So within your family, how many siblings were there? Were your parents adherent to the have as many kids as possible thing?
Yeah, my family, we had 7 kids. So I'm right in the middle. There's 3 older than me and 3 younger. 4 boys, 2 girls. But yeah, absolutely. My mom was just kind of leaving that up to God, having as many as she possibly could. But yeah, I'm happy that we're all here. I'm happy that I have all my siblings. I can't imagine life without them, and I wouldn't want any of them not to be here. But my parents, I do think, had too many kids. I don't think they were physically, emotionally, mentally able to care for all of us, which is another huge problem that you do see within this cult, is there's so many kids, and the parents, they do their best, to their credit, the majority of them, I'm sure. I know some parents are just awful and are in the cult for the wrong reasons to have that power and control, but the majority of them, I think, you know, were doing the best they could. I know my parents certainly were, and they were trying their best to care for all of us in all of the ways, but there was just no way. I mean, neglect is inherent. You cannot physically provide everything a child needs mentally, spiritually, emotionally, physically, like all of the ways with that many kids. And that's why in this culture, you see so many of the children being parentified, especially at very young ages, and then being forced to kind of take on that parent role in the household with not just cooking and cleaning, but with actually caring for the younger siblings. Mm-hmm. They had this whole system designed. It's called the buddy system. The Duggars followed it. My family followed it, where you pair a younger child with an older child. And the older child is kind of then the parent of that child, keeps an eye on them out in public so they don't get lost or separated from the family or anything like that. I was a middle kid, so the parentification in my family, there was a little bit with me, but it was very minimal. I would say my older siblings, particularly my oldest sister, she suffered the most from that parentification. She was definitely the second mother figure in our home. Mm-hmm. And I know, I don't want to like speak for her or say too much about her story out of respect for her, but I know that was something that affected her negatively and just, yeah, was not healthy for her whatsoever.
Yeah, I can imagine. And I know that within the IBLP, they really propped up the horrible, disgusting Michael and Debbie Pearl book, How to Train Up a Child. We did a whole episode on it. Was that part of your household as well?
Yes, we had the book. I actually remember finding it in our little family library downstairs one day. And I was, as a kid, just like leafing through it and like looking at it. And, like, I don't know why I was looking at that book, but I do remember we did specifically have that book. I don't remember myself personally being blanket trained. I think my mom did blanket training with my youngest brother. They had 6 kids, and then my youngest brother, he came along much later. He was definitely a surprise baby. You know, my mom was older at that point, and she didn't think she was going to have any more kids. Then he came along, so I helped raise him. I took care of him a lot, and I loved taking care of him. Yeah, I remember she did a little bit of blanket training with him, but I don't remember her purposely, like, trying to lure him off, and I don't remember her, like, slapping or hitting him. with an object when he did.
Okay.
So I don't think my mom adhered to blanket training as much as she quote unquote should have, according to the cult, which that was lucky for us. Yeah, it definitely was. Yeah, we were aware of it. We did it a little bit, as far as I know. We have the book.
Okay. So for those who aren't familiar, it's basically a book on how to your children into submission. It's really awful. The blanket training that we're speaking of, I believe they put an infant, usually around 6 months old or a little bit older, on a blanket. And instead of like the normal blanket training is encouraging them to reach for toys, encouraging them to crawl off the blanket. In this case, it's you put their favorite toy just out of arm's reach off the blanket. And when they go for it, you slap them or hit them with something to encourage them to ask for your permission to do anything, at which point you have a very submissive child, which is really just a child who's living in fear.
Yes.
And so we know that it's very common for people in the IBLP to follow this book because it was recommended by Bill Gothard. And there's other things like if you're breastfeeding and they bite you, you're supposed to pull their hair or pinch them. It recommends various switches of various sizes, how to hit your kids, what to hit them with. It's just really disgusting. And most of the comments on that video and anytime we talk about it are, you know, I'm not for book banning except in this case because it's so horrible. So I wondered if that was a part of your life, if you ever remember them trying to hit you into submission or going overboard with spanking, which I'm not for spanking in general anyway. I wondered if that was a part of your upbringing.
Oh, absolutely. Corporal punishment was definitely something that my parents practiced. We were spanked for sure. To my parents' credit, I guess I was not aware of this until I watched the Shiny Happy People documentary, but I guess it was common in the cult for spanking all the way up into adulthood to occur. And sometimes husbands, I guess, were like spanking their wives. My dad never did that.
Not in a fun way, by the way.
No, not in a fun way. Definitely not. As far as I know, I mean, I never saw my dad ever in my life put his hands on my mom. And we were only spanked up until the age of 13. And that's when my parents would cut off the spanking and then, you know, they would turn to other punishment methods. So, but yeah, growing up all the way up until 13, we were definitely spanked by hand. Otherwise, there was the particular tool my parents used, to their credit. At first, they did use wooden spoons, but they stopped as soon as they learned that wooden spoons, I guess, were like really, really bad. I don't know if it was like, it could somehow hurt the child's like development. I mean, obviously, it's going to psychologically hurt their development. But I don't know if like there was something physically about it that was like too extreme in their eyes. So they quit using the wooden spoons. And then we just had a rubber spatula. And there was one in particular that was the spanking spatula. And I would often have to go retrieve it myself. My dad would be like, all right, go get the spatula. I would have to get it, bring it to him, and then I would be spanked with it. So corporal punishment was definitely a part of our childhood. And I think just because of that, like, to me, I'm so disgusted by it, and I think it's completely wrong. Growing up, I actually thought it was okay up until probably my 20s, not even that long ago. I really did think that spankings and corporal punishment was okay, and I was like, well, I was spanked, and I turned out okay, which I did not turn out okay. I have a lot of mental health issues, so that clearly was delusional on my end. But also my big thing growing up until like my 20s, I was like, well, I don't understand how or why spanking works. It doesn't make sense logically to me, because to me, I'm like, I feel like that's hitting your child and that's wrong. But I was like, but you can't argue that like kids that are spanked, like it works, like they're well behaved. So I'm like, clearly it works. But now I'm seeing as an adult, you know, after I've been out for longer and had a lot of therapy, I'm seeing it works because it's abusive. Like it creates fear.
Yeah.
And then the person is, yes, giving you the behaviors that you want, but only out of fear because they don't want to be hit. Like no one wants to be hurt.
Yeah, exactly. And there's so much research now to prove that it's psychologically damaging in ways that we didn't understand in the past. And so I think that's something that a lot of parents are trying to change and break the cycle with, especially millennials. I definitely will be one of those parents. So what were some of the things that they would punish you for? Looking back now, were you out of line? Not that you deserved it, but were the punishments in correlation with some of the stupid rules that you really shouldn't be punished for? Were you actually trying to rebel? What was your situation like?
I think it was a mixture of both. Like when I was really little and getting spanked, I guess in their eyes I was acting out. But a lot of times I think it was like I was being too loud. I was being sassy. You know, if I talked back, I would get spanked. A lot of times I would get spanked if like I was goofing around in bed at night instead of going to sleep. And they would like give us warnings multiple times. And then if we didn't follow the warnings, then we would get spanked. Yeah, I think more so when I got older and the spankings had stopped by then, I was getting in trouble for things that were more along the lines of like I wasn't following the rules. I was doing things behind their backs that I quote unquote shouldn't have been doing. But it was stuff like talking to boys, and like the boys were like talking sexually or talking inappropriately to me, and I didn't understand even what they were saying. So to me, I was just like, I didn't get it because I didn't understand like what certain things meant because I had been so sheltered and repressed. But then of course I got in trouble, and I don't think there was like any actual punishment, like being grounded or having privileges taken away. I certainly wasn't spanked by that time, but I was the temperament. My parents kind of were able to figure out our temperaments and then sort of tailor their behaviors, their reactions, or their punishments to our temperament. So for example, they would definitely be like, my younger sister was treated differently than me because I was easier to control, because I was more of the personality, like highly anxious, just easy to scare, easy to kind of almost like psychologically beat into submission, I guess. Because I remember one time in particular, you know, just getting in trouble for this boy that was talking to me over Facebook and sending really inappropriate messages. And I bore the brunt of that as the female, not the boy who was doing the inappropriate behavior. And I just remember like my dad was so angry about it and so, so harsh. I don't want to talk badly to him. My parents are not bad people. They were doing the best that they could. And I think they were very stressed and very overwhelmed, just A, with how many children they had, B, living off one income, because my mom wasn't allowed to work. She stayed at home to take care of us. But then the entire brunt of that financial burden fell to my dad to care for this entire family while also trying to give us quality time at night after work, teaching us our math lessons for the next day after work, trying to take care of his wife. Like, he had a lot on his shoulders, I'm sure. And I'm sure at that time he was like very overwhelmed in life. And so I think probably some of that frustration and harshness that came out of him in that situation, I mean, I think his reaction was too much. It was incredibly harsh, like so harsh to the point that it was like a little bit traumatic for me. And that is partially because it was too harsh, and also partially because I am so, so sensitive. I'm the type of person that really would have benefited and thrived under gentle parenting. But yeah, so I think he was doing the best he could, but it was completely overboard. And yeah, so I don't remember him like actually punishing me. He pretty much just kind of like guilted me into sending this boy an apology message that I had not acted Christ-like. And then I had to like unfriend him, delete him from my Facebook. And my parents also cracked down on our Facebooks. Then they wanted our passwords. And my dad was, I assume, checking my Facebook. I know for a fact he was checking my internet history and just like very, very controlled, very tightly controlled eyes. We were just like eyes on us, watched like hawks all the time. Me in particular, because I was the middle kid, and some ATI parent at one point had told my dad, you know, you have to watch the middle kids. They're the ones that get forgotten, and they're the ones that then rebel and are really bad and do really bad things, get into really bad things. So then I had like laser focus on me because of being the middle child.
Wow. Yeah, I'm sure that felt really invasive. And that's not to say that you shouldn't be watching out for what your kids are doing and monitoring their internet searches and things, but there are boundaries that kids should be able to have to be able to feel independent in some way within guidelines, of course. Were you guys also part of the homeschooling program that they had?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's how we got into it, because my parents, with their first two or three kids, I think they did public school initially, like preschool or kindergarten or something like that. And then I think it was not too long after that that my parents, I don't even know how they ran across ATI, the advanced seminars, the basic and advanced seminars rather, or the ATI homeschooling curriculum. I don't know like how that came into their awareness, how they found it. Somehow they came across it and I guess it looked good to them. So they got into it. And at that point, then they pulled the kids out of the public education they had started them in, and then started homeschooling them and all the subsequent children that came along. So like you said at the beginning, I was born into it. I've never spent a day in my life in public school. I would be so curious what that's like. Yeah, just born into it. It's all I've ever known.
Yeah, and the homeschooling program, it is not a complete education. I feel like that's a fair assessment. So if you could just explain some of the things that you were learning in homeschooling, just so people have a full understanding, it's not just you're learning everything that you would have in a public school in a home setting, because I think that that can be possible with homeschooling. It is very much religious based and a lot of subjects omitted and changed based on the Bible or Christian teachings. So what are some of those things that you can share with the audience to give them a full picture of what you were actually learning with your homeschooling?
Yeah, so it was very religious based. The homeschool curriculum, they were called wisdom booklets. I think they were like 52, 54, something like that. And Bill Gothard claimed that the wisdom booklets were a complete education, that I think by the time you finished them, they were equivalent to, I think it was like a high school.
Is it a law degree?
Oh, is that? Okay. I've heard that. I was like, I didn't even know if that was true, because I'm like, that's
it
so
sounds ridiculous.
Insane.
But I feel like one of our other guests have said that. And so that's why it's triggering a memory. It's like either a law degree or something of the sort where it's like, really?
I've heard that.
When I looked at some of the sheets, because I remember going through some of them and being like, this is absolute nonsense.
Yeah, not only is it not a complete education whatsoever, like all those claims are completely false and completely ludicrous. But when you actually read the wisdom booklets themselves, not only are they inaccurate scientifically with a lot of the things that he says, but you can definitely see the bias. You can see the religious slant. You can see the brainwashing that's woven in with the things that they teach, the wording, the language, everything. There's some very highly problematic ones in particular, which I know other people have talked extensively about. There's a whole section on modesty in one, and eye traps, and identify the eye traps on the drawings of the women. I don't know if it's that same wisdom booklet or not, but in one of the wisdom booklets as well, there's a whole teaching on basically SA and what happens if you're a victim of SA, and basically teaching that if you are a victim of SA and you don't cry out when it's happening, you are 100% equally at fault as the person that did it to you. So it's victim blaming, victim shaming, things that are just not just wrong, but horrific to teach. Just like, I can't, now that I'm out of it and as an adult, I'm like getting a little heated even like thinking about it, but I'm like, I can't believe these teachings are even out there. I can't believe that this is something that someone sat down and wrote and that millions of people are reading and are just like, okay, like agreeing to, like, it's horrific. It's absolutely awful. I can't even believe that this is out there.
Yeah, and clearly not based in any sort of science or psychological training, because if anyone knew about trauma responses, not everyone tries to fight.
Exactly.
Fight, flight, freeze, and fawn. There are so many different ways that you can react when being assaulted, and to say that if you don't cry out that it's your fault, or, well, they say that if you're assaulted no matter what, it's your fault, right? Like, you asked for it somehow. But even then, if you don't cry out, then it means you wanted it or something. It's so disgusting and awful, because I can just imagine the damage that that has done to so many people who have been in that situation and somehow blame themselves or feel like they can't come forward because they will be blamed. It's just really sad.
Yeah. And I feel like it's specifically created that way too, to then silence victims and to hide and protect their abusers. Because if you feel like, oh, I caused this, I did something to bring this about by the way I either acted or dressed, or because I didn't cry out, then you're going to keep silent. You're not going to want to go to someone and say, this happened to me, and expose the person that did it to you, because you know that you're going to be blamed. So it's another way to just, like, it's so predatory completely predatory. Yeah, the way it just protects predators and creates an environment for them to come in and flourish. And we saw that with Josh Duggar. And a lot of people said within ATI, including my parents, Josh Duggar, he's a rare case, a rare bad apple. And he is not. He is common. There are Josh Duggars everywhere in this cult. They thrive in this cult.
Yeah. And for those who don't know, he assaulted his younger sisters and a few other young girls. I don't remember all of the details.
Yeah, I think it was his sisters and one other girl, a babysitter maybe. And then later also it came out that he was cheating on his wife, having an affair with her, or an affair on her while she was pregnant.
Oh my gosh.
There's allegations from, I don't know what all I can say, so I'll call her a star. I can't remember her name. Was it Danica Dillon? For some reason, that name is in my head. Allegations that he was like highly, highly abusive and violent towards her when he paid for her services. And then later it also came out and he's in jail now.
For having on his computer of children.
Yeah, child materials, like not even because that implies consent and children cannot consent. And it was not just child materials, but the top five worst, like the worst of the worst you possibly can get. And that's another, I'm not giving Josh Duggar any passes, by the way, but that is a result of growing up in this type of culture that is so oppressive and repressive, where normal sexual urges or behaviors are so, just so oppressed that it really kind of almost encourages weird stuff, encourages weird perversions in some people, I've noticed. And it really just breeds an unhealthy, unnatural curiosity in that type of thing. It's very common for brothers to be doing things to their sisters in this culture because of that oppression and just the rampant curiosity that is natural and is normal and could be dealt with in a healthy, normalized way, but is not. Yeah, and I just think in this type of culture, it's very common for people to get into really terrible things. I mean, also, I don't want to give Josh Duggar a pass, so I don't know, like, maybe this is something that was just in him, and either way, you know, whether he was raised in this culture or not, he would be a predator. I don't know. I can't say, but yeah, it's definitely a culture where this kind of thing thrives, and it breeds it. I think that's the term I'm looking for. It kind of breeds this type of unhealthy behavior, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I agree, especially because they hypersexualize children. When you're telling a child they need to cover up or they're being too immodest and they're drawing in the male gaze, that gets people thinking. It makes the older brothers or whoever it is think, okay, so I can sexualize them because they need to cover up, because they're being too sexy. And so it does create this weird perverted mentality instead of just letting kids be kids, you know? And we could get into that, I'm sure, for another 2 hours. From your perspective and your childhood, I mean, you're a very beautiful woman. Thank you. I'm sure that you dealt a lot with men hitting on you or being inappropriate. And I'm wondering how, if that were the case, how that affected you being a teenager and just trying to go through life. Maybe did you try to make yourself smaller? Did you want the attention? Or was that a part of your teen years in any way, aside from the Facebook messages that you've already mentioned?
Yes, I definitely, since I was small, I can remember having terrible sexualized interactions with men. And it was definitely not something I ever wanted or enjoyed. I thought it was creepy. I thought it was scary. I thought it was weird. I did not like it at all. But growing up in this culture, from a young age, we were taught, you know, men are visual. Men are going to be noticing you. They're going to be noticing your body. So as a result, from a very young age, I feel like I knew too much. I knew things that I shouldn't have known. And I would always watch men from a very young age. Always my whole life watched men, and I watch their eyes, and I watch what they're doing. I watch what they're noticing. And I always notice men's eyes on me and notice like, okay, where are they looking? Like I'm hyper aware of it. And I was hyper aware of it from a young age, which I think is really unhealthy for a young kid to A, be aware of that, and then B, be noticing it and just having it be such a normal, regular part of life and being taught like cover up. Like if you wear pants, men are going to look at your butt. And if they look at your butt, then they're going to start envisioning having sex with you. If they see any cleavage, my mom literally told me that she's like, you know, if men see any cleavage, any amount of your breasts, they immediately think about having sex with you. And do you want men imagining that with you? So again, kind of almost placing, you know, the responsibility on me as well. But yeah, so from a young age, I would notice men and notice how they were like noticing me or other women. My first job ever was at a public library. I was somewhat young when I started, which again is kind of interesting. You know, we were still in the cult at this time. So it's interesting that my parents let me have a job because I was kind of outside of my design and my gender role that I was supposed to adhere to. But they were open-minded and progressive, surprisingly, in a lot of ways, to their credit. But yeah, so my first job, I started at the library. I was probably like around 14 or 15 or something like that. And I remember it was really uncomfortable a lot of times because, you know, it's full of men. A lot of men would come in. They'd be using the public computers. And every single day I would see men, you know, watching porn on these public computers and then going to the bathroom.
Oh my gosh, and then, that's brave of them.
Yeah.
In a public library?
Yes, yeah.
Guys.
It's embarrassing. It's embarrassing for them when you think about it, but they had no shame.
Yeah.
And then they were definitely sexualizing me every time I would walk by or like walk by pushing my little cart of books to shelve. You know, they're looking at me, they're checking me out. I would notice all of that. And I would just, I'm naturally very introverted and shy anyways. And then add on this layer of being sexualized with these disgusting, gross, creepy old men. A lot of them are old enough to be my father, old enough to be my grandfather. Like I would just burn inside with just like the humiliation and just the uncomfortability of it. I hated every second of it. And I was just so relieved when I would finally get to the bookshelves and be able to like hide in the shelves and like shelve the books. I would have a lot of men hitting on me. At that time, I had moved, well, later on, when I was, it was more like 18 or so. I did move out and I lived on my own. I was very poor. I rented out a room in some random stranger's house. I didn't have transportation for the longest time. So I would just take the public transportation. And a lot of times on the bus, I would see these creepy men that would be at the library all day, like just acting creepy towards me. One man in particular, I noticed he purposely made it so that our paths would cross. He was like waiting for me to kind of cross his path. Like I could see him waiting. And then he tried to talk to me. So I saw him on the bus later. And then it was dark one night and I somehow missed my stop accidentally. Maybe I was like lost in thought or something. And then he leaned over to me and he didn't say it out loud. He whispered, which I thought was extra creepy. He was like, "Wasn't that your stop back there? You know, weren't you supposed to get off?" So not only were these men on the bus with me, they knew my stop. They had made, like, they knew exactly where I was supposed to stop and get off. So just knowing that, like, these men are aware of where I live, like, the general vicinity, could literally get off with me and follow me home, probably. Like, I just felt very unsafe, very creeped out all the time. Again, there was an element of it just being normal and feeling normal dealing with creepy men. Even like going to some family events, some family members, I won't say which side of the family, anything to like give it away. But I would notice like how some of my uncles and cousins would look at me and my sisters. And when we would first walk in, like I would just notice all of this stuff. So to an extent, there was just an element of it being normal, but also I knew it wasn't normal. I knew it was gross and I knew it was disgusting. And I was just disgusted and infuriated by it. And to this day, you know, I will still kind of feel that trigger a little bit if I notice men kind of like creeping or perving on women or just staring, leering, anything like that. I get so heated and I get so protective of women because from a young age, I had that attention directed towards me and I would see it around me all the time. And I hated it so much.
Because it's completely out of your control.
Yeah.
It's something that you've been told is your fault and that you are supposed to have this ability to control their thoughts and their actions based on how you present yourself and what you wear. But in reality, you're just a beautiful woman and they're staring at you. And so you're probably internalizing this going, oh, well, they told me that they were going to stare at me. I must not be doing something right. Or that's just how the world works. And I guess men are just creepy and pervs. And that's just part of your reality. Yeah. And so I could see why you wouldn't necessarily question it, even though it felt wrong and uncomfortable. You're in this environment that's telling you that it's your fault. And so I'm sure that had a lot of effect on you and created a lot of internal turmoil.
It did, yeah. And I think it definitely led to like some of the eating disorder, or tied into some of the eating disorder stuff that happened during my, I guess, adolescence, teenage years, early adulthood. Yeah, I even remember one time on vacation somewhere, we were at some hotel, you know, in the lobby, like having the continental breakfast or whatever it was. And there were a bunch of grown men, truckers, that had stopped there as well. And I remember we're all eating and I was wearing something that my parents didn't love me wearing. They let me wear it. Yeah, if they could have had their way, they would have just said, don't wear it completely. And it was just a tank top. It was just a tank top. And it did have these like little holes kind of along the hemline. So I would always wear like a little shirt underneath to be more modest. So you couldn't like see through the hole, just to have like another, like, yeah, little layer on. And these grown men, I'm an underage child at this point, they were perving on me. They kept like walking back and forth and like staring. And my dad noticed, he was aware of it. And I kind of noticed it a little bit too, but I'm a kid, so I didn't like think too much about it. And, you know, I'm kind of in my own world with my siblings and like we're watching the news that's on because that's exciting, you know, to have the TV on. And so then later when we're back in the hotel room and we're having our daily morning family Bible study devotional thing, my dad is like reading the Bible and praying. My dad brings it up and he was upset about it. It bothered him. But instead of being upset at these grown men who are perving on his child, and instead of going up and saying something to them or anything or even giving them a look, I was shamed for it. He told the entire family, and it was in the context where I felt incredibly shamed and like it was my fault because I'm wearing something so immodest. It was literally just a tank top, not immodest whatsoever. But because I was wearing that and my parents didn't want me to wear it, I think they kind of use that as justification. Like, well, this is why we don't want you wearing this type of shirt, because men will perv on you. And it's like, no, men should never perv on children. That's not normal. That's not a thing. Only predators perv on children.
Yeah.
And children shouldn't be shamed for grown men's inappropriate behavior.
I agree. Do you remember how old you were?
Probably around the age of 13, somewhere in there.
Is this around the time that the eating disorder started? And you don't have to talk about anything you're not comfortable with. I just wondered if that was part of it. You were trying to have some level of control.
I think it definitely started just from feeling that lack of control for sure. And then kind of morphed into other things as it progressed. Yeah, the eating disorder started technically, I think, around the age of 10. That's when I started noticing in ballet class that I looked different from the other girls. All of their stomachs were flat and mine kind of poked out a little, probably because I had just eaten lunch and it's normal for your stomach to stick out after you eat. But I didn't know that. I didn't know that it was normal for your stomach to stick out. And I was just like, why is my stomach not like that? So I started like being very conscious of my weight and my body. It started sucking my stomach in at that point. But the actual like behaviors didn't happen till I was maybe closer to like, maybe 12 or 13. I'm not for sure exactly. But yeah, it definitely started with like restricting and just being very hyper aware of my body, not wanting to gain weight, not wanting to be fat. And I do wonder if, like, I don't specifically remember being taught to stay slim and attractive. I don't remember those type of teachings. I don't remember hearing anything like that. But I do wonder if it was out there and I was like hearing about it, whether it was in the wisdom booklets or something else, and it was still seeping into my consciousness because I was so hyper aware of my appearance and my body. And that's another thing in this cult. The appearance is very, very much hyper focused on not just being modest so that you don't cause your brothers in Christ to stumble and sin, but also we were supposed to portray a certain image. All of our attire was supposed to draw the eyes to the countenance, so the face, instead of like your body. You weren't supposed to wear anything distracting on your body, anything that would like draw the eye to any particular body part, you know, like a plunging neckline would draw the eye to your chest, a long necklace would draw the eye to this area. So obviously like everything was kind of orchestrated to design or to draw your eye, other people's eyes to your face. And then supposedly you were supposed to always be just happy and cheerful and just radiating, you know, the joy of the Lord. And that's how we were supposed to be a witness for Christ in that way, was people were supposed to be drawn to our countenances and then see, you know, all the joy and the love of Christ in our faces, in our eyes, and just be so like mesmerized by that, like, oh, you have something different. You're different and you seem really happy and I want what you have. But it was all fake. Anger was an emotion that was not allowed. Ironically, a lot of the men in this cult, especially the fathers, have anger issues and are highly, highly angry. But, you know, especially, you know, in kids, we're supposed to be submissive and well-behaved and perfect and never angry. And especially as women, we were never supposed to be angry. There was a long stretch of my life where I didn't experience anger. And it wasn't that I wasn't experiencing anger. I was not aware of it because I was suppressing it so much. And I think it was coming out in other ways. And I think it came out in the eating disorder. You know, I think there was anger behind that as well, I'm sure.
Yeah. I'm so sorry that you had to deal with that. It's so difficult. And it's common to find something that you can be in control of. I remember having body dysmorphia. I mean, I honestly think I still do at this point. And I left Mormonism 10 years ago, 11 years ago, because it creates this perfectionism complex where you have to be this perfect Mormon woman and you have to look perfect and you have to act perfect and you have to smile and you have to be pleasant. And all of that just really culminates into this body dysmorphia of, okay, do I look good enough? But I can't be sexy, but I need to be hot so I get a righteous guy, but not too hot because then I'll look slutty and people will stumble if they look at me or they'll lust after me. It's this really uncomfortable place to be in growing up. I just went into detail on another podcast on Mormon stories, and it's funny, as I was talking, I was like, oh yeah, this is a really confusing way to grow up that I've never really spoken out loud before. But once the words were flowing, I was like, that is incredibly confusing, because you are supposed to attract your, in Mormonism terms, your eternal partner, but you can't be attractive or else it's your fault if someone looks at you in a sexual way. It's just really confusing to deal with. So all that to say, I can understand and empathize with what you were going through in some capacity. And I wanted to talk about the training centers, because I know that We want to get to the end of your story as well, and how you kind of came out of that and did take control of yourself and your sexuality, which is awesome. But first, I want to talk a little bit about your experience at the training centers. Why were you sent there? Was it a punishment, or was it because your parents wanted you to do well? What's going on there?
Yeah, so I got sent to various programs within the cult. One of the really popular ones was Journey to the Heart. My oldest brother took me to that, and then later my younger sister went, and because of her experience at Journey to the Heart, that's kind of how we started to see it for what it was and leave the cult. So I went to that. My mom took my younger sister and I to some other various programs as well. Probably the most extreme and the most impactful, aside, of course, from the yearly conferences that they held every year in Knoxville, Tennessee, for the ATI families, those were very impactful as well. We didn't go to them as much later in life, but definitely early on. But aside from that one, I would say I was sent away for 3 months at one point. I don't remember exactly which training center it was. I think it was probably either the one in Michigan or Chicago. I don't remember either what it was called, but I assume it had to be Commit or some like branch of Commit, because Commit, the acronym Commit, was the older girls program. And at that point, that was the age I was at. So I think it was Commit. But they did send me away for 3 months, and my parents kind of phrased it as, this is something we're going to send you to, and we think it would be really great for you. We think you'll really love it. It was like phrased very positively. Okay. But in hindsight, I can see, I think my parents were sending me away because they were concerned. And I kind of started to catch on that, oh, this isn't some fun, exciting opportunity or a privilege that I have that I get to go do. I'm being sent away because at one point my mom was like, how are you feeling about going? And she was like, we're not sending you away. You know, we just think this would be really great for you. And then immediately when I got there, one of the other girls who was very troubled, you could tell, she was like, so what are you in here for? And I was like, what am I in here for?
And then it clicked.
Yeah, I was like, that's a really interesting way to phrase it. And I was like, well, I don't think I'm in here for anything in particular. Like, I didn't do anything bad. But my parents, you know, like I said earlier, they were so hyper-focused on me. I had the eating disorder that was very severe that they were very concerned about. I was self-harming at that point. So I think they were just concerned and they didn't know what to do. And in this culture, we are not taught to go to outside sources. So therapy is highly discouraged, to put it mildly. Therapy would be considered sinful. To go outside of the church, outside of the cult, to literally an outsider who's of the world, like, we were taught, first of all, they can't possibly help you because they're not coming at it from a biblical perspective. But yeah, like, that medication, therapy were never an option. We were kind of taught, again, that it's not that you need therapy, it's that you need to get right with God. And that's literally what my mom told me at one point. She was like, you know, if you were just right with God, if you were more godly, you wouldn't have an eating disorder. It would just go away.
Oh my gosh, that's so awful. I just have to validate that that is not the case, and that's horrible, and that should never have been put on you.
Yeah, and then initially they did take me to the doctor when they found out I had the eating disorder that I was really trying to hide, and the doctor recommended therapy. And so I asked my mom when we got back home, I was like, okay, am I going to do therapy? She was like, no, absolutely not. And I was like, well, Mom, if I don't get therapy, like, how are my problems going to get fixed? And I remember she said, problems? What problems? You don't have any problems. You just need to eat more. So everything was just, you know, these Band-Aid solutions, or just, you know, like, you need to be right with God. You need to pray more. You need to read your Bible more. My dad allegedly cured his depression through reading the Bible more. So stuff like that, that's just not healthy. You know, if you have a brain imbalance, no amount of reading a book is going to fix that. You know, medication is there for a reason. And I think it's a tool that if you wanted to look at it from a Christian perspective, I'm not a Christian, but I would say to any Christians, you know, that's a tool that God designed and gave to us to use. You know, it's not evil.
Right. Medicine.
Yeah. It's medicine. It's literally medicine for your brain. Your brain gets sick too, like the rest of your body. Like, that'd be weird if your brain didn't get sick. You know, it's part of your body. Like, that's a very normal human experience. There's no shame. There's no judgment. I'm trying to remember where we were going with that. I kind of forgot the question that you asked.
No, that was a great tangent, by the way. Thank you for sharing that. I think we were just talking about how you realized when you got to the camp, oh, I'm here because I did something wrong. Yes. Or because they're trying to fix me.
Yeah, so I was there for 3 months. And at that point, it kind of clicked, like, oh, I think I might be here because I'm kind of a bad kid. And again, not bad, just dealing with mental health issues and growing up in a traumatic environment.
Yeah.
It was a terrible, terrible experience, honestly. I was very lucky, again, in that I was not one of the kids that ever, like, really got in trouble there. So I was never locked in solitary confinement, thankfully. I can't even imagine having to go through that. But it definitely was not a fun environment. Very, very strict, very rigid, very controlled. We were doing free labor, literally free labor for them. And I was underage at the time as a minor doing free labor for this cult. The girls in my group, I think there was maybe like 5 or 6 to a group. And then we had a team leader who was another ATI cult member. And they usually were pretty young. They probably couldn't have been older than 20, I would say, probably. So very, very young girls were leading us. And then I'm assuming it was to give them a break or maybe teach us leadership skills. But at one point we each had to lead the morning Bible study. And I think I only did it once. I don't remember doing it more. I think I would remember that because I remember just doing it the one time was so stressful and anxiety inducing for me. But they had us doing that, like basically leading the sessions. So kind of doing the work for them too, in a sense. And just like the most prevailing potent memory I have is every single day crossing off the day before and just counting down, like, how many more days do I have to be here? How many more weeks? And I remember looking at 3 weeks and being like, okay, I only have 3 more weeks. Like, I could do this just day by day, try to get through it. Like, just literally trying to talk myself through it and just being so, so miserable. And I do think that kind of broke my spirit a little bit, which would be perfectly in alignment with the cult's tactics, everything, you know, with the blanket training, even all of it was designed to break our spirits, which to me is so sad.
Yeah. If you could describe a single day, for example, like what time did they make you wake up? Did they feed you? What type of manual labor were you doing? When did they allow you to go to sleep?
We woke up super early. It had to be around probably 5 or 6 in the morning. Ooh. Yeah, because we had devotions, the Bible study in the morning, super early before breakfast. And then I think after breakfast, we would go into sessions and we would be in sessions all day. So we would be listening to speakers, or sometimes they would have us like learn valuable skills. So at one point we were learning some type of like crochet or some type of sewing or something like that. I just remember it being really, really...
Of course.
Yeah, of course. But I remember it being super tedious and just really difficult. I really hated it. And we were like, I don't know, it was like crocheting something on like a bonnet or like something I would never wear.
Crocheting a bonnet.
Yeah. And another class, they literally taught us, you know, how to walk with good posture. We had books on our heads, like old fashioned type stuff. Like we were walking with books on our heads. One session, they taught us how to walk up and down a staircase like a lady. And to this day, I cannot walk down a flight of steps without thinking about that and being like, okay, keep your eyes up. Don't look at your feet, you know, hold the, like exactly how they taught me to do it. Like to this day, it's just like cemented in my brain. Like these random things will just pop up. Anytime I walk down a flight of stairs, I'm thinking about that. And I'm like trying to like not look at my feet like they taught me. So like silly things like that, that are really not important. We probably had free time. I don't remember having free time. The only free time I remember having is every day for like an hour, they would let us go outside to one particular park. We all had to go together. And I think it was mandatory that you had to walk for 30 minutes. And then if you wanted to rest and like just chill out, hang out outside for the rest of the 30 minutes in the park, you could, or you could keep walking. I had an eating disorder, so I walked the entire hour. But I think that was our only free time. I think we had some free time on the weekends where we'd probably just like be in our rooms, like reading our Bibles or something. We might have had some free time after dinner. I think there might have been a little bit of free time after dinner for like phone calls, because they had limited phones. And it was like always kind of almost a competition, like to get the phone, because that was your one lifeline to the outside world. And we had limited time. We weren't allowed to be on the phone past like a certain time, and other girls were waiting. So then, of course, like there was all this like pressure to have a short phone call, which sucked. And I just remember, too, it was in a public place, so you could never have a truly private conversation, which I think, you know, obviously they designed that on purpose to have the phones in a public location. But I was heavily self-harming at that time. It was obvious. I knew that people knew because I saw them look at the self-harm scars that I was trying to hide on my wrist with like bracelets and things. And no one said anything. To this day, I'm like, why did no one say anything? Why did no one try to help me? I'm actively cutting myself in my room at night. Yeah. Like, why? Why didn't someone try to help me? I don't understand that at all. Like, I clearly needed help.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was kind of a typical day. They did feed us. Yes. I think they fed us adequately. At the time, again, I had an eating disorder and I was vegan. So a lot of things had dairy. A lot of things I couldn't eat because it wasn't vegan. So I, for 3 months, I lived off of fruits and vegetables. I lost a ton of weight. And I just remember being hungry, just being consumed by thoughts of food all the time and literally laying in bed at night fantasizing about like, I'm going to go home and eat granola and I'm going to go home and eat this and eat that. I was so, so hungry. And like, yes, it was technically my fault because I'm not eating adequately due to this vegan restriction. Because at the time I was like, well, I don't feel right eating animals. I think that's wrong. Like I can't in good conscience eat something that was alive and had a beating heart. But they didn't have alternative options for people that had dietary restrictions. It was kind of like, this is the food. And if you can't eat it, you can't eat it. And so I just was very hungry all the time.
I can understand you wanting to take some accountability for that. And also at the same time, though, if it's supposed to be a place for rehabilitating kids who are, quote, troubled, they should have noticed that you were losing a lot of weight. They should have noticed that you were eating. They should have noticed that you were self-harming. They should have been there to offer help and support. Even if they don't believe in therapy, they should have done something to help you instead of just ignoring all of these things. And I feel like that was a huge ball that was dropped. And it seems like being put in this training center actually made your situation a lot worse.
Definitely. Yeah. There was nothing positive that I got out of it whatsoever. I really can't think of anything that I learned. And at the like, I didn't even make good connections with people just because of the fact that I was so, so shy and so, so socially awkward. I really struggled socially there. And a lot of the other girls, I think, didn't like me because I was so quiet. But I didn't know any other way to be. And like, it was painful to exert myself. Like, I was so painfully shy. Yeah, so I really can't think of anything, not even any meaningful connections that came out of that time, unfortunately.
Were you able to discuss any of this with your parents during those brief phone calls and tell them that you were struggling?
No, I, growing up, like, I always just dealt with things on my own. And it's not like I remember ever being like taught to do that. I think that was just kind of the culture and the environment. It just fostered, you know, hiding your problems and trying to deal with everything on your own. Because, yeah, there was a lot of things I dealt with growing up, a lot of things I had anxiety over, and I never told anyone. It didn't even cross my mind. Like, maybe I should tell someone, maybe I should ask for help. It just, it wasn't even an option. It wasn't even a thought in my brain. It was just, this sucks. I hate this, but I just have to deal with it. And I can't wait for it to be over. Like, there were years, years and years and years of night terrors where I was terrified to go to sleep at night. And I really didn't ever say anything. Like, my parents found out because I would wake up, or they would wake up to me screaming, but it just was kind of laughed off. Like, oh, Anna was screaming last night. Oh, haha. Like, she was doing that weird thing again. Like, it just was brushed off. These things that, to me, as an adult, I feel like are very obvious signs that like something's going on. Your kid's not okay. Something's happening to them. Like,
right.
You should look into it. The signs are all there. But again, you know, if you're sleep deprived and you have so many children that you can't take care of and you're just overwhelmed, like, of course, you can't handle it all and you're going to miss a lot of things, I'm sure.
Well, especially if mental health is not acknowledged or recognized in any sort of way, it doesn't seem like they or you had the tools to even put words to how you were feeling. I think there's been such a huge influx of awareness around mental health in the past 10 years or so, where all of us millennials are going, oh, that's something we need to take care of just as much as our physical health. And people are normalizing therapy now. And it's so great that we can start to unwind our traumas and dig into them and figure out how to heal them and find peace. But I think back then, especially in a group like that where they're demonizing therapy, there's really no language to express or address what's going on with you, what's going on with your kids, for example. So I imagine that that was really something that wasn't even a thought, like you were just mentioning. I didn't even know there was an option to get help. But I have to think that when you came home from that training center, it should have been blatantly obvious that something was going on with you. Did your parents ever see the scars? Did they recognize that you were going through a really difficult time at that point? We actually ended up speaking for over 2 hours, and so we decided to split this episode into two. In this next episode, we're going to discuss what happened when she got home from the IBLP camps, her parents' reaction, how that further led to more body dysmorphia and eating disorders, and how those decisions and that mentality actually permeated into her adult life. It led her down a road of becoming an exotic dancer, uncovering her sexuality as being gay, and we're going to talk about how she was able to truly discover who she was. So stay tuned. If you want to support Oceana, you can find her on her YouTube channel at Oceana333. We will put the link in the description. And if you want to support even further, just those words of encouragement mean a lot to our guests. Leave those comments down below. If you want to support the podcast even further, you can find some of our merch at cultstoconsciousness.com under the merch tab. You can become a patron at patreon.com/cultstoconsciousness. If you want to do something fun and go to Costa Rica, we're doing that at the end of August. You can find that in the description. And if you like this video, I will link two more down here below. And until next time, watch out for that next episode. Follow your highest excitement, be conscious, and be well. Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, it would mean a lot if you could like and subscribe on YouTube and leave a review or a comment to help with our visibility. You can also find me on social media at cults2consciousness or reach out by email at cults2consciousness@gmail.com.